back to another edition of the Dog and Duck Show. We are back after a week hiatus. We took last week off dealing with some work issues and other kinds of trips and vacations and those kind of things. But we are back. I'm with my co-host, Mark Schmoor. We're going to talk some Husky football. We're going to talk some Duck football, Pac-12, NFL, and more. Mark, how are you doing, my friend?
Warren, I missed you. I missed having the Ducks and the Huskies playing. Fortunately, there was a lot of other dramatic action to draw us in on Saturday, but good to be back with you. Good to be looking forward to more games this weekend.
Absolutely. After a disappointing loss to Oregon State, I have to say it was healthy for my mental well-being to just disconnect for a little bit from Husky football. We're now standing at 2-3 with an embarrassing loss to Montana, a really, you know, painful loss to Oregon State, and then just being humiliated by Michigan, our two wins being Arkansas State and Cal. And now we come off of our bye week facing the Chip Kelly-led UCLA Bruins, who, you know, they're not quite as hot as they were before losing to Fresno State, but this is a dynamic team with an incredible running game. They've got two runners that are regularly running for over 100 yards per game in Zach Charbonnet and Britton Brown. And that this is a dynamic offensive team that I'm not sure if we can stop them. But before we get into that, I did want to say that if you are listening to the show, the Dog and Duck Show is an extension of Impact Players, which is an organization that I lead here on the east side of Seattle. And our mission is to inspire men to be great husbands, fathers, and leaders. And once a month, we've got a breakfast on the second Thursday of the month. And this morning we had our first breakfast of the Impact season. And we had a special guest. We had Tony Castricone, the voice of Washington Husky football and basketball. And he did a phenomenal job this morning, sharing a little bit of his story. Mark, you were there at the breakfast. Maybe just, you know, share what your experience was as a fan of college football, as a fan of Impact Players. What was it like being at the breakfast this morning, and what did you think about what Tony had to share?
Well, in addition to being a fan of college football and a fan of Impact Players, I'm a huge fan of play-by-play broadcasters. And I too, yes, as a kid, grew up pretending to be a play-by-play broadcaster. You know, I would oftentimes put the computer on autopilot. I wouldn't even play a video game. I would just let a video game play, and I would be announcing it from across the room while acting out the play. So to hear how this kind of passion has fueled Tony throughout his life, and that it's been this, I mean, this grind from different outposts to different outposts, you know, doing the most random schools, sporting events, just to kind of give himself experience and time behind the microphone. Like, I was really inspired just to kind of hear the journey of persistence. He's obviously someone who's very talented and has a great voice, which is not his own doing, but this is also a guy that has put together, years, decades even, you know, we're close to two decades, I think now, of just grinding it out and doing whatever he could to kind of get the next opportunity, even if it meant sleeping on the floor of an empty apartment and barely having enough money to make ends meet. It was a really great to hear his story and just hear a little more about how that has shaped him.
Yeah, I agree. It was cool to hear the story, and, you know, just to be reminded that like guys don't just normally wake up and become play-by-play announcers at major universities. Like it takes a lot of work. And, you know, like you said, he had a job where he was getting up at 4 a.m. every morning for 3 years, you know, getting paid $70 a week, doing games for high schools for free, with, you know, less than 10 people listening online. And, you know, and so it's an encouragement to everybody out there. I think especially as men who are, you know, we're all pursuing our career goals, just to keep grinding, keep pursuing. But I think also as dads, as we're kind of reminding our kids, hey, you know, nothing's given to you. This entitlement mentality, it's not going to get you where you want to go. But if you grind it out, if you put in the work, you know, good things can happen. And that was really cool. So I enjoyed having Tony join us for our breakfast. And believe it or not, in the midst of it all, he didn't really talk a lot about Husky football. And that was okay. We were okay with that. But we will pick up the mantle and talk some Husky football now. And, you know, actually, Mark, one of the things about this Pac-12 season that's been kind of unique for you and I is that at the beginning of the year, we joined a fledgling fantasy football league for Pac-12 football. So just within the Pac-12, on my fantasy football team, I've got Kyle Phillips, who is a star wide receiver for UCLA, and Greg Dulcich, who is their star tight end as well. I believe you've got one of their two dynamic running backs on your squad. And I think the point of me sharing that is just that it has caused me to be more in tune with what UCLA has been doing offensively up until this point under Chip Kelly. So Mark, as a, you know, as a longtime Duck, as somebody that's, you know, seen and watched Chip Kelly up close for many years, what are you seeing from this UCLA team and Chip Kelly that is reminiscent of the Ducks under his reign? And maybe is there anything that's different where he's kind of, you know, changed up the formula a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, I think he's changed up the formula a lot. You know, I think he said something to the point of, well, when I came to Oregon, we had flashy uniforms and we spread the field and we picked up the tempo because nobody else was doing those things. And now that I've come back into the college game, everybody has flashy uniforms and is speeding up the tempo and spreading the field. And so we have to find a different way to be productive. And so what I've seen, the bits and pieces of UCLA games that I've seen, is certainly this is the best UCLA team that Chip has coached to this point, and has an abundance of talent on the offensive side of the ball, especially. You mentioned Kyle Phillips and Greg Dulcich. So he's got one of the best receivers in the Pac-10, one of the best tight ends in the Pac, or I should say Pac-12, two of the best running backs, one of the best quarterbacks. Like, he's got all these kind of toys to play with. And the result is a pretty dynamic, entertaining team, especially offensively. Having said that, I think it's a little bit kind of disappointing for UCLA fans that this team has already lost two games.
Right.
And that's because their defense hasn't always backed them up. You know, they lost 40-37 to a Fresno State team, which we remember Jake Haener playing kind of the game of his life in that game. That was a thriller. And then they lost a game to Arizona State, which I think was closer than the score indicated. The final score was 42-23. But like total yardage wise, Arizona State had 467 yards. UCLA had 453. So like if you just watched how they moved the ball, like those two teams were pretty equal. There were some kind of funky things about it that made the score more of a blowout. But they can move the ball. I think what has kept them from being the leader of the Pac-12 South right now is that their defense just hasn't been up to the challenge. And so, you know, that's kind of the opposite of what Washington faces, right? Where Washington comes in with a pretty sturdy defense that you feel like can at least keep them in the game. But the question is, where are the points going to come from? So I'm always kind of fascinated when you have a matchup of those two extremes where it's like, can the Washington D just slow down this hyper athletic offense just enough to kind of give their own team a chance, or can the offense kind of find their groove a little bit against the UCLA defense that seems like they can be susceptible?
No, that's a great point. And that really leans into what I was going to share. But, you know, you mentioned the way that Chip Kelly has had to change, because he said, hey, when I came into the league, you know, it was spread it out, speed it up, and nobody else was doing that. And so that was the way to kind of create an advantage. And I think, you know, a few years later, Jimmy Lake comes in with Chris Peterson, and he created a defense that was geared for teams that were spreading it out, splitting it, you know, like speeding it up, lots of throwing. And of course, we've seen great success with that defense, especially against Mike Leach and the Air Raid Cougars. But again, as the pendulum has swung, we are now seeing that teams are taking advantage of that Jimmy Lake defense that for 4 or 5 years in a row was the number one defense in the Pac-12 statistically in terms of scoring. But right now, you know, we're going into this game with a UCLA Bruins offense that is second in the Pac-12 in rushing with 217 yards a game, second only to the Oregon State Beavers, who ran for over 300 yards against us just 2 weeks ago. And our rushing defense is one of the worst in the league. We're a 10th in the league, allowing 179 yards per game. And quite honestly, you know, if you look at what our rushing, you know, what our rushing defense is like, in taking out the Arkansas State game and even the Montana game, I mean, we're giving up near 300 yards per game rushing. So this is a really nasty formula for the Washington Huskies to try to overcome coming into this game. Now, granted, you know, when it comes to passing defense, the Huskies are, you know, first in the Pac-12, only allowing 147 yards a game, but that's like one of the most misleading stats I can, you know, ever think of, because it's been so easy to run. Why would you throw the ball? So I think this game, maybe more than any other this season, if coming out of a bye week, they don't figure out how to stop the run, knowing that that's exactly what this team is preparing to do, then I'm not sure if there's going to be any coaching staff left by the end of the season, because the offense, as you mentioned, has proven to be inept. And the defense, which has a track record of being successful, but has really struggled this year, if they can't figure it out this week, it's going to be hard for Jimmy Lake to recover. Because it's one thing for him to say, well, you know, I'm not an offensive guy, but as a defensive guy, he's got to get this thing figured out.
Yeah, these are all good points that you raised, Warren. And I just want to underscore it by pointing out something that is just kind of mind-boggling. And that is that Washington has lost games to Michigan and Oregon State when their quarterbacks threw for less than 50 yards through the air. Less than 50 yards through the air. And both of them, it was low completion percentages. It was not an efficient 48 yards passing. It was, you know, 7 for 15 for 48 yards or something like that, I think was Chance Nolan. So I think this is why I was saying I think Washington still can be a good defensive team. You're right. They have gotten slaughtered in the running game in a way that I don't think any of us saw coming. But they have been so good thus far in kind of shutting down the passing game that to me, with a week off, there has got to be a way where Jimmy Lake and his coaching staff and Bob Gregory kind of go into the film room and they start drawing things up on the board and they just kind of figure out a way to make Dorian Thompson Robinson beat you through the air and really limit the ground game. Like I'm with you. It's like, this is put up or shut up tie now for Washington. There's still a chance, you know, that they could make it interesting in the Pac-12 North race. If they can win this game, like they're still a factor there. But man, you've got to do a better job against the run than they've shown the capacity to do thus far.
Yeah, it's hard to even think about anything in terms of like season-long goals because there's not a lot of hope that we're going to get better. So if we can come out, if we can show that we can stop the run against UCLA, if the offense, you know, can put together four quarters of creative play calling and make some dynamic plays enough to, you know, I think that the magic number is 35. If the Husky offense can score 35 points, they're going to win maybe 90% of their games. But the problem is that they've struggled so much to get beyond 27. And it doesn't matter if you're holding your opponent to under 35 points a game, if you're consistently scoring less points than your opponent, you're still losing, you know? And so that's kind of the big challenge for the Dogs this week is what are they going to do to stop that rushing defense, rushing offense on defense? And then offensively, you know, what we've seen is in almost every game other than Arkansas State, we've seen this defense, this offense be completely dormant and inactive for at least two quarters in a row. And you just can't do that in college football. You can't go entire halves without scoring in college football and expect to win. So they've got to put it together for all four quarters. Dylan Morris needs time to throw the ball. He needs to make the right reads. He needs to be given the opportunity to go downfield. And we've got all of our receivers other than Jalen Polk back now. There's no reason not to attack. I believe Cade Otten should be back in the fold this week. There's talk that ZTF may potentially be making his comeback this week. So if ever there were a time to really put together a strong, impressive performance, it would be at home, coming off a bye with all of your players getting back healthy again. If it doesn't happen this week, it's not going to happen, in my opinion.
I think that's fair. What are they? They're 2-3 right now. So if you lose a 2-4 start is just, it's pretty dismal.
That's brutal.
When you've got what are probably the two best teams in the conference in Oregon and Arizona State still waiting on the back half of the schedule and a pretty tough Stanford team on the road. But if you win, you're 3-3, you've won 3 out of 4, you've won 2 out of 3 in conference. You've got Arizona coming up next, who's winless. So thus far, you recognize that games against Colorado and Washington State later on down the line are winnable games that could probably get you into bowl contention. So yeah, this does feel like kind of an interesting turning point.
It feels like if we win, it means that we've figured something out. Yes. That's kind of what I think. Yes. If we win, we figured something out. And if we can take that and move it forward, you know, because I mean, statistically you're right. Like we're 1-1, Oregon State is 2-1. And, you know, within a week or two, you know, we could be at the top of the conference. That's totally reasonable, but only if we can win. So otherwise it's just delaying the inevitable. You know, I'm kind of tired of hearing Jimmy Lake say, we still have all of our goals in front of us. And it's like, you can't have all your goals in front of you if you're 2-4. There's no way. Yeah. So, but well, let's talk about the Ducks. Give us a preview on what they have coming up this weekend, and what's the chatter in Duck Nation right now?
Well, like the Huskies, Oregon is coming off a bye, and similar to you, you were kind of ready to take a week off after that loss to Oregon State. I was not in a good state after the Oregon loss to Stanford, and I need to give a shout out, Warren, to one of our faithful listeners. Jared in Corvallis was really looking forward to listening to the Dog and Duck Show after Oregon lost to Stanford and the Huskies lost to the Beavers in the same week. Texted me. He was like, I can't wait to listen to you guys this week. And I explained to him that I was out of town and that we were on hiatus for a week. And he was so disappointed. And of course, then the Beavers followed that up by losing to the Cougars. So any sort of inflation that he was carrying has now been deflated. And the Beaver fans are feeling very much like Husky fans and Duck fans coming off a loss. But
And I mean, you know, we can circle back to this, but wow, what a win for the Cougars. If ever a coach needed a win,
oh yeah,
I think Rolovich picking up a win against a hot Oregon State team, it's just classic Cougars.
Yeah.
Right. You know, they beat a team that nobody expects them to beat. And you go, oh, okay, well, that's the Cougar win this year that, you know, everybody will remember.
Yeah. That's absolutely right. So, in terms of, you know, thinking about the Ducks, there is kind of some negative juju, you could say, that needs to get worked out on the field right now. You know, I'm not going to get into everything regarding the loss to Stanford, but, you know, suffice to say, it was a game that Oregon had in hand. I think they had like a 98.9% win probability, according to ESPN. With the ball, 2.5 minutes to go, a first down wins the game. They punt the ball to Stanford. Stanford's on their own 4-yard line with a 2nd and 19 that they convert and then move their way down the field thanks to a few penalties that I would say at best were questionable calls. Stanford wins the game in overtime and just a crushing loss for the Ducks, which has happened to them from Stanford more times than I can count. So if you just take the loss to Stanford and just say, well, Oregon is coming off of, you know, a brutal overtime loss to Stanford in which they really should have sealed the game up with 2 minutes to go. That's one element of what's facing this Oregon team. Now add to that a few other pieces. One, offensive coordinator Joe Moorhead was rushed to the hospital prior to the Stanford game with an undisclosed medical emergency. He was in the hospital for most of the bye week, is my understanding. I believe he will be present and calling plays for the Cal game this Friday. Mm-hmm. But obviously that kind of, you know, has been an issue that kind of has some things in flux. Added to that was during the bye week, it was announced that both running back CJ Verdell and defensive back Bennett Williams suffered season-ending injuries, which is just a devastating blow on both sides of the ball to lose really two of their best players through the first half of the season. Adding to that, Warren, you have Kayvon Thibodeau, who they have struggled to even just kind of get on the field for an entire game. Yeah. He plays against Stanford. On that fatal last drive, he has a hit on Stanford quarterback Tanner McKee that was ruled targeting. He is now suspended for the first half of the game this Friday night against Cal. So you have all of this kind of swirling around, and it just kind of feels like, okay, like there are a lot of things that have been going against Oregon here, and the best way to combat that is to come out Friday night against a 1-4 Cal team and just kind of take control and prove yourself to be the more dominant team. I think the thing that maybe people looking at this from afar might not realize is Cal, I think, is much better than a 1-4 team.
Yes.
You know, if you look at their schedule, they lost a close game, their season opener, to Nevada, who's one of the best teams in the WAC. They lost by 2 points to a good TCU team when they failed to convert a 2-point conversion near the end of the fourth quarter, which would have sent that game into overtime. They lost to your Huskies in overtime.
Yeah.
Now they also lost to the Cougars in a game that wasn't necessarily a good loss for them. But the point is they've been in most of their games. Yeah. And really just kind of come up one or two plays short in each of them. They beat the Ducks last year, shut them out for the entire second half. So I have no reason to believe that this is going to be a decisive game in the Ducks' favor. I have some confidence because of it's at home, but I fully expect Cal to be in this game going into the fourth quarter.
No, I agree. And Mark, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I believe that Cal is also coming off of a bye. Is that correct?
That is also correct. Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, so the advantage of having a bye is somewhat negated by the fact that Cal also has a bye. Like you said, this is a talented Cal team. They gave the Huskies, you know, a real run for their money. You know, their quarterback, Chase Garbers, is very experienced. I think he's playing his best football of his college career right now, making clutch passes, running the ball really well. And they've got some dynamic playmakers that have really, you know, done some good things out there. In terms of their defense, it's really hard to judge how good their defense is watching them against the Huskies, because the offense is so bad for the Dogs right now. But they, especially in the second half, they were consistently getting pressure on Dylan Morris, which made life really difficult for him in that second half of the game. And ultimately, like, we won the game in overtime by running the Wildcat against them three or four plays in a row, that basically we just took the ball out of Dylan Morris's hands and didn't even attempt to throw, because it was so futile for us. But, and if it weren't for a massive defensive play to end the game, I don't know if we would have beaten them just trying to score touchdowns in overtime. So I think this is going to be a tough game for the Ducks. You know, you mentioned they're at home. That definitely works, you know, that definitely helps. But with all the things that you mentioned, and, you know, coming off of a loss, I think this will be a good test for these Ducks.
Yeah, you know, you made a joke about Jimmy Lake's comment, what is it, all of our goals are still ahead of us, you know, and how you're getting tired of hearing that phrase. The thing about it with Oregon is that statement is very much true. Like, they lost to Stanford, who then turned around and lost to Arizona State. It's their second conference loss for Stanford. Yeah. So Oregon can still win the North. They don't need anybody's help. If they win out, they can win the North. If they win out, they've got a very good chance still at getting selected for the playoff, because they have that win over Ohio State in their back pocket, who has only gotten better as the season has gone on from there. So all of their goals are still in front of them. And at the same time, like, I don't have the feeling watching Oregon that I'm watching a top 10 team, that I'm watching a playoff contender. They very much looked that way against Ohio State. They have not looked that way really in any of their other games to this point. I think, you know, you would still have to consider them the favorite or the co-favorite with Arizona State to win the Pac-12. But there are several games on the second half of their schedule that I think will come down to the fourth quarter. You know, they've got UCLA coming up in the Rose Bowl next week. They still have to go to Utah, who's been improving. They still have to go to Washington. Mm-hmm. They play Oregon State at the end of the season, who's a better team this year than they were last year. So simply put, if you've got the ranking the Ducks have, you need to take care of a 1-4 team. At the same time, there's something about this game Friday night, an underdog that is better than the record indicates, that I just have a feeling it's going to be closer than the experts might think.
I agree. So you mentioned Kayvon Thibodeau. He'll be coming back in the second half, but is he fully healthy now?
You know, they are saying that he is. I mean, I'm guessing he wouldn't be out there unless he was fully healthy. You know, he was not the factor in the Stanford game that I thought he might have been. But I think he might have been a better, more of a factor in the second half than maybe I give him credit for, because they really did shut down Stanford's offense in that second half. So it just feels like, you know, he was out for the Ohio State game. Then he was out for, I mean, the Stony Brook game doesn't really matter. He played about 10 snaps against Arizona. So he's this kind of mythical creature. You know, he was knocked out in the Fresno game after kind of dominating the first quarter. So we just haven't really seen him put together like a full four quarter game where he's just terrorizing an opposing quarterback. And if that comes this week, it would be a great time to kind of have that element to added to the defense.
Mm. Yeah. And so with CJ Burdell out, Travis Dye is going to be the lead back for this offense. How does that change the way that this team functions? Is it business as usual, or will they do something different because Dye is a very different type of back than CJ Burdell?
Yeah. I mean, Burdell is a much more physical runner than Dye is. And so I would assume that, that there are carries that went to Burdell that will now go in other directions to other players. You know, the interesting thing about Oregon from a running back perspective is Sean Dollars was a guy that was kind of expected to maybe have a breakthrough season a little bit. Last year he played well in the Pac-12 championship game against USC, filling in for CJ Verdell. Mm. Well, they lost him to an injury in the spring, serious injury. So along with Travis Dye, they've basically got three freshmen that they're going to be running out. That's Trey Benson, Byron Cardwell, and Seven McGee, who we really haven't seen much from any of them thus far this season in terms of meaningful snaps. So the hope is that whether it's by committee, the three of them, or whether it's one of those guys kind of taking the mantle, they were all highly sought after recruits. You know, you figure there is some talent there, but they're going to have to now, you know, do it on the field. So, and that's where this whole thing with Joe Moorhead just kind of, you know, you would love to know that your offensive coordinator is able to kind of give his full efforts to like game planning around the loss of your star running back. But I don't think anybody really knows what his health status is or what his capacity is to do that sort of thing. So there's just so much unknown right now about how Oregon is kind of handling all of this.
Well, looking at the rest of the Pac-12, you know, clearly the premier Pac-12 game this weekend is between Arizona State, which is ranked number 18 in the nation, and Utah. Utah really started off pretty rough. I believe they began 1-2, but now they have won their last two games in a row, which has them at 3-2 overall and 2-0 in the conference. Arizona State is 5-1, 3-0 in the conference, with their only loss coming against BYU. So, Mark, as you look at this game, do you favor the Sun Devils to keep the momentum going, or is Utah kind of the antidote to whatever Arizona State is pushing out there?
You know, I think Arizona State has, their peak seems to be higher than what we've seen from Utah, but Utah is also coming off of the best game that they've played, which was against USC this past weekend. Everybody seems to be playing their best game against USC this year. There is a storyline in this game, though, Warren, that I'm kind of interested in that goes beyond, you know, who gets supremacy of the Pac-12 South. And that is kind of a couple tragedies that have surrounded the Utah football program. They had a player, Aaron Lowe, defensive back, who was fatally shot earlier this year, late September. He was shot and killed in the evening after a game, you know, out celebrating with his teammates in Salt Lake City. And this, of course, came in the wake of an accidental shooting of another Utah player, Ty Jordan, last December, who's a star player for Utah. And they actually named a scholarship on behalf of Ty Jordan. They named the Ty Jordan Scholarship. And the first player to receive that scholarship was his good friend, Aaron Lowe, who was this player now that was shot and killed in September. And so I believe the whole team traveled down to Texas for Aaron Lowe's funeral and then came back together and played this game against USC, where they obviously played very well. Obviously, you know, when you're talking about things of this nature, like who wins and loses on a Saturday, you know, can be so trivial. I mean, what that Utah team and the coaching staff have kind of had to navigate through is just, it's kind of jaw dropping. And at the same time, if you do just want to kind of look at it through a football lens, you acknowledge that sometimes these are the very things that kind of bring a team together to kind of play beyond themselves. And so I don't know if that will be enough for Utah to overcome the Sun Devils, but I think the nature of this story and the nature of the tragedy surrounding this team has me really just pulling for Utah. I'd like to see them successful, that could bring some sort of, you know, healing to these guys who have lost two of their teammates in the span of a year.
Yeah, it certainly does add a layer of human emotion to this game that, you know, I think honestly, I mean, as painful as it is, I think that it's those stories and the reality that these are real people that I think for those of us who have been engaged in sports for a long time, it really does help shape what it is that we love about sports. Because, you know, if Utah can come out and win this game for Aaron Lowe, for Ty Jordan, there's some level of healing that takes place in those kind of moments. And that's what I love about sports is that, you know, it can do things that help us process the pain and the hurt and the struggle that we're feeling in our everyday lives. And there's no doubt about it. Like you said, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, football is just a game. These are real lives that we're talking about. But, you know, I think one thing that I think is a great plus for this Utah team is they've got a leader in Coach Kyle Whittingham that I think has got maturity. He's kind of a rock, you know, he's there. He's like an oak tree that you can depend on. And so I have no doubt that he's going to help guide this team through the mourning that they're experiencing. And then on the other side of the field, you've got Herm Edwards, who also has a lot of experience, a lot of maturity. A lot of those players look to Herm as a father figure in their lives. And he's got this team really moving in a good direction, you know, with this 5-1 record, in spite of all of the preseason, you know, controversy, and who knows what happens when the season is over. But if you're an Arizona Sun Devils fan, you got to feel pretty excited about the way things are moving right now.
Yeah, I think Arizona State Sun Devil fans are happy to take a Pac-12 championship and a trip to the Rose Bowl if it's then wiped off the record next year. I think they'll take that trade. They haven't had a lot of that to root for since the days of Jake Plummer. So
yeah, you mentioned Jake Plummer. I was going to ask you, is Jaden Daniels the best quarterback since Jake Plummer?
Yeah, I think the only other one that comes to my mind was, Brock Osweiler was pretty good for Arizona State back in the day. Those are the only ones that come immediately to mind as like relevant Arizona State quarterbacks. You know, there's probably one that I'm leaving out here since I didn't research this ahead of time, but Jaden Daniels is certainly on the short list of the best quarterbacks they've had there over the last 25 years or so.
Yeah, and I mean he's had a good season. I wouldn't say it's been spectacular, but in this season of, you know, really what I would call kind of flattening of college football, yeah, with some of the superpowers coming down and some of the more unexpected teams playing better, there's an outside chance that he could get into the Heisman, you know, conversation. You know, he's currently got right around 1,300 yards passing and a little less than 400 yards rushing. So, you know, if they can keep winning and he can keep doing that dual threat type of quarterback role, there could be more hype coming on him. And Mark, as I mentioned, kind of this flattening of the college football season, perhaps no more apparent than the loss of Ohio State to Oregon, the loss of Clemson to NC State, and now this past weekend, the loss of Alabama to me was a very unimpressive Texas A&M before that game. Mark, is this just the gravity of losing all of the talented players that they did lose over the season finally hitting home for Alabama?
I have no explanation for it, Warren. I mean, there is nothing that Texas A&M had done, especially offensively. I mean, this is a team that beat Colorado 10-7. That's how limited they were offensively. We now know Colorado is seemingly not a very good team. You know, they're one of the worst teams in the Pac-12. They might be the worst team in the Pac-12. Texas A&M was lucky to beat them 10-7, was as unimpressive as you can be.
At home, right?
At home.
Yeah.
And so with a backup quarterback, Zach Calzada, who struggled to beat Colorado, he goes in and plays against top-ranked Alabama and throws for 285 yards, throws for three touchdowns. And it had this feel of this game, Warren, where like Texas A&M is ahead, but you've watched Alabama win so many games that it never really felt like Texas A&M is going to win this game. You know, even when, and there was a point I think where Alabama blocked a punt and scored, and it was kind of like, okay, here comes Alabama, and then Texas A&M immediately runs the kickoff back for a touchdown, and it was kind of, oh, Texas A&M's hanging around. And then, you know, I think it was a 1-point game, 31-30. Alabama comes down, they throw a wide open touchdown. I mean, nobody even on the half of the field with the receiver who's catching the touchdown. And it felt like, okay, that's it. Alabama's going to go up by 7 now. They convert the 2-point conversion. It's 38-31. That's it. Like, it just felt like, okay, that's it for Texas A&M. And what do? They drive down and score. They get a 3-and-out, they drive down and kick a field goal. And I have no memory of a team as off the radar as Texas A&M. I mean, this is the first unranked team that Alabama has lost to since Nick Saban's first season. Like, they just don't lose games to teams like this. And so it was absolutely shocking. It was one of several thrilling finishes on Saturday, just wild, crazy games all day. I think we're going to have more of them. I think that will be the theme of the season for sure.
Yeah. Well, Mark, you do a weekly article for sportspac12.com. Is that correct?
Yeah. And,
sure. Am I getting that right?
Yes. Yes.
And so you normally do your top 25 review. Georgia obviously thus far into the season has the most impressive record. Do you see them now being, the favorite to win the SEC, or, will Alabama right the ship and, go run the table the rest of the season?
I can't believe I'm saying this, but I think Georgia, looks significantly better than Alabama at this point in the season.
Yeah.
And I mean, nothing would surprise me, if Alabama goes into the SEC championship game and beats Georgia, it wouldn't surprise me. Mm-hmm. But Georgia, their starting defense has given up one touchdown all season. Auburn was the first team to actually score a touchdown on their starting defense all season. Last week they beat Arkansas 37-0. Arkansas then turns around and loses to Ole Miss 52-51 and puts up 675 yards or something like that. So Arkansas is this prolific team. I mean, they scored 40 points against Texas. Like, they're a team that can get up and down the field, and Georgia completely shut them out. And so,
just like they did to Clemson.
Yeah,
and every other team this season.
And the Clemson game is the one that people still kind of are raising their eyebrows at, because if you remember, that was a 10-3 win. It was a really ugly affair. I mean, we know that Clemson's defense is still pretty good, even though they've underachieved. It hasn't been the fault of their defense. But Georgia's offense since then, like, any concern that maybe their offense was going to struggle, like, since that Clemson game, they've scored 56, 40, 62, 37, and 34, including the last two against Arkansas and Auburn, who were two top 25 teams. And, they're scoring in the 30s in those games. So I don't think there's any real problems with them. Now, their toughest part of their schedule is the next 2 weeks. They play an undefeated Kentucky team this week at home. It's going to be the third ranked team in a row that they've played. I think Kentucky is like a legitimate top 20 team. I think they're good. I don't think they're as good as Georgia, but they're pretty good. And then they turn around, they get a bye, and then they'll finish up the month of October playing Florida in Jacksonville on a neutral field in the world's largest outdoor cocktail party, as they call it. So they've got four games in a row against top 20 teams: Arkansas, Auburn, Kentucky, Florida. They've won the first two in convincing fashion. If they win the next two, they should coast to an undefeated season, regular season, and I would assume play Alabama in the SEC championship game.
Yeah, it's a great review. Nicely done. And I would say, I think, I think you've already mentioned it multiple times. This is a topsy-turvy year. And, and I've talked about this. I talked about this before the season even began. But I just felt like, wow, if there was ever a time where things could turn on their heads, it was this year, because of the fact that most teams retained more players than they would normally retain because of the extended rules of eligibility through COVID. But at the same time, teams like Georgia, Ohio State, and Clemson sent excessive amounts of players to the NFL. So there is a little bit of an imbalance that has evened the scales a little bit. I've actually got a couple friends that were at the Texas A&M game this past weekend. And, they were on cloud nine, of course. But the word that I got from those guys was that the A&M home field was just electric. And of course, you may know this, Mark, but the original 12th man actually was from Texas A&M. And the Seattle Seahawks borrowed it and then ultimately kind of bought it. And then they transitioned to the term the 12s. But the idea of the 12th man really originated at Texas A&M. And they were at their very best against Alabama this past weekend.
It was the type of game, Warren, that like it, I think is why we love college football so much, in that like, you've got 106,000 people there. You've got a huge underdog, you know, with the backup quarterback in against the top ranked team. And why college football is unlike any other sport is this is a regular season game. Texas A&M might go, you know, they could still end up going like 7-5 and not being a great team this year. But the fans who were in the stadium for that game will remember that game for the rest of their lives. Like 20 years from now, there will be fans who are at that game that'll be tailgating outside, and the name Zach Calzada will come up and they'll start remembering different plays. And we know this is true because we do this, you know, in thinking about games from our own life. And that only happens, I mean, that can happen at the playoff level with any sport, if you're thinking about kind of the ultimate. But in terms of like a regular season game for a team that doesn't go on to do anything of note,
yeah,
college football is the only sport where those kinds of things get imprinted into the memories of the people that are there in a really specific way. And yeah, it's why we love college football.
It's my favorite sport. It's why we talk about it more than anything else. But, you know, since we did mention the 12th man, let's talk for maybe just a couple minutes about the Seattle Seahawks. It's not been a good year for Seattle football with the Washington Huskies 2-3 and now the Seattle Seahawks 2-3 as well. Russell Wilson, for the very first time in his career, is going to miss a start this Sunday night against the Pittsburgh Steelers. He injured, it broke his finger against the Los Angeles Rams. He tried to come back in, couldn't grip the ball, had to turn it over to Geno Smith. Geno Smith performed admirably, but ultimately gave up a devastating interception to kind of wrap things up against the Rams. But this is going to be something that we haven't seen in a long time, and that is a Seattle Seahawks team without Russell Wilson. What do we expect?
Not much. Do we have a timetable for how long he's going to be out? Is there an estimated timetable of his?
You know, I think that the number that is kind of what doctors would say is 6 weeks. You know, I know that Russell Wilson and Pete Carroll, being the ultimate optimists, are believing that he'll be able to recover faster than that. But I think 6 weeks is what would be medically expected.
So I'm looking at their schedule over the next 6 weeks. They're at Pittsburgh, who has been struggling this year, who does not look like peak Pittsburgh Steelers team.
Roethlisberger looks like he's completely done.
Yeah. They're home against the Saints, who have been hot and cold. I'm not sold on New Orleans this year. They're home against the Jaguars, who are the worst team in the league. They're at Green Bay, who is having a typically strong season. They're home against Arizona, who is maybe the best team in the NFC. And then they're at a half-decent Washington team. It's not out of the realm of possibility that they could go 4-2 or 3-3 during that stretch if Geno Smith is just kind of competent. Mm-hmm. I think 3-3, I think anytime you have a backup come in for a short term and win half their games, that's kind of what you're looking for the backup quarterback to do.
Yeah.
But I also think, so what would that be if they go 3-3, they're 2-3 now, that would be 5-6.
Yeah.
And you've got Russell coming back and you've got games remaining against the Niners and the Rams and the Cardinals, and then, but also really winnable games against the Texans, the Bears, and the Lions.
Yeah.
So it's not out of the realm of possibility that this team could somehow find their way into the playoffs if Geno Smith can just kind of hold serve and then they can get hot to end the year. But wouldn't you say that even with a healthy Russell Wilson, this team looks like the third or fourth best team in the NFC West?
I would say absolutely. And I think the real problem here, Mark, is that you're right. They could conceivably go 500 over the next six games, but they're not going to beat Arizona. They're not going to win any of the in conference games during that six games. And the problem is that Arizona and the Rams in particular just keep widening the gap with their excellent play. And so you've got the Cardinals are 5-0 and the Rams are 4-1. I don't see them slowing down enough to even allow the Seahawks to have an opportunity, even with a healthy Russell Wilson. Even if Russell could, let's see, what are they? They're 2-3 right now. If Russell could take them 8-3 the remainder of the season, I'm not sure if that's enough, because this Rams team and this Cardinals team, they look like they're both Super Bowl contenders.
Yeah.
So, you know, Seahawks fans, you know, we have to kind of come to grips with the fact that with or without Russell Wilson this year, there's a good likelihood that we will not be getting to the playoffs. And if we don't make some major roster changes, it doesn't look like the future is peaking towards us right now with, you know, Kyler Murray and all that he has ahead of him. Matthew Stafford looks completely rejuvenated in Sean McVay's offense. There's no doubt about it in my mind. The NFC West is the best conference or best division in the NFL right now. This is going to be a tough hole for the Seahawks to dig out of.
Yeah, very much so. It looks like in the NFL as a whole, I mean, there are five teams in the NFC that seem a cut above everyone else. You've got Arizona and the Rams, as you mentioned. You've got Tampa Bay with Tom Brady. You've got Green Bay with Aaron Rodgers. And the Dallas Cowboys looking like far and away the best team in the NFC East and a genuine contender. And then in the AFC side, there's kind of, I would say, three teams right now in Buffalo, Baltimore, and the Chargers that look like they're operating on full capacity. And depending on how you feel about Kansas City, as will they get their act together in time for the playoffs, they're kind of the wild card that has major questions right now on defense. So I wouldn't put them in that same category. But that's about eight teams that it feels like are kind of the shortlist Super Bowl contenders, teams that you could see winning three playoff games in a row. And I would say the gap between those teams and the rest of the league seems to be pretty considerable. And so whatever the next tier is where I would put the Seahawks with a healthy Russell Wilson, but that does not, there's a gap there, I would say, between those top eight and the next tier down.
Yeah, I agree. And, mentioning the Chiefs, I think that's probably one of the biggest stories of this year, is the fact that they're 2-3 coming off a loss to the Bills. And they've got Washington this weekend, which is, I would think, a get right game for them. They shouldn't have any trouble. But then they've got the Titans coming up right after that. And then they've got matchups against the Packers, the Raiders, and the Cowboys. So this is going to be, it's going to be interesting to see what Andy Reid and Mahomes can cook up to kind of get back into the race. And I think, you know, similar to the conversation related to the Seahawks, you know, maybe the question that I might pose to you, Mark, is looking at those names that you mentioned of the Bills, the Chargers, the Ravens, and the Titans, who are each leading in their division. You know, which one of those teams are more likely to stumble that might, you know, allow a Chiefs team to kind of get back into the playoff picture?
Well, I'm not sure it requires one of those teams to stumble as much as it just requires. I mean, you look at Kansas City's three losses are to Baltimore, the Chargers, and Buffalo. And Buffalo, the Buffalo one was a convincing loss, but, you know, the Ravens one was a game that they seemed to have in hand and then kind of let it get away from them. So they've arguably played the three toughest teams in the AFC. They happen to lose all three of them, but the Chiefs are generally that team that kind of beats the teams they're supposed to beat with some regularity. And so I would just kind of assume that over the course of the season, they're going to start stringing together some wins. It may not be enough to overtake the Chargers and win the AFC West. And I think that would be the interesting storyline, is if the Chiefs come into the playoffs having won, you know, 9 of their last 11 or something like that, but they're playing on the road in the wild card round and they have to win 3 straight games on the road and they're not playing at Arrowhead, that's where it can really, you know, shift the playoff race and how these early losses can really kind of haunt you towards the end of the season. But I just think that right now their defense is not putting them in position to win enough, and they just don't seem like as complete a team as Buffalo, Baltimore, and the Chargers are.
Yeah, I mean, I think Josh Allen looks like he's starting to fire on all cylinders. Lamar Jackson, he looks like he is putting it all together. He looks, the last couple games, he's looked as good or better than his MVP season. You know, I don't know what to make out of Derek Carr and the Raiders, especially with Gruden's, you know, resignation, but up until their last two losses, Derek Carr was really looking good. And then you've got Joe Burrow and the Bengals starting to pick up some steam offensively as well. There's some interesting storylines in this.
You're leaving out my man, Justin Herbert.
Oh yeah. No, I mean, Justin Herbert has been phenomenal. I mean, he's an MVP candidate right now.
Yeah. Yeah, really fun group of young. I mean, we've talked so much about Mahomes in the last few years, just as a football fans, but like the combination of Josh Allen, Lamar Jackson, Justin Herbert, Dak Prescott, Kyler Murray, that all of these guys are probably going to be quarterbacking in the playoffs this year. Mm. It's just such a fun young generation of super talented quarterbacks that are all probably going to end up losing to Tom Brady or somebody.
No, I mean, you, that's an excellent point. And I was thinking about that over the weekend, that it does seem like now it's very clear that this is the new generation of quarterbacks. And obviously Tom Brady is the ageless wonder, who is like, I mean, Tom Brady's like 3 or 4 generations, you know, older than these guys in terms of quarterback iterations. And then you've got Russell Wilson, who's kind of in this bridge, but
and
Aaron Rodgers. But then, you know, guys like Ben Roethlisberger, he looks like he's done. Of course, Phillip Rivers left at the end of last year, and
Drew Brees retired.
Drew Brees, you know, so it does feel like now, really, other than Tom Brady, it feels like this league now belongs to the young guns.
Yeah, and especially the AFC, where there really is no, I mean, because the NFC with Brady and with Rodgers and even with Russell Wilson, if he gets in there, you could still have, you know, it come down to kind of the old guard against the young guard. But in the AFC, it's all young quarterbacks. I mean, Roethlisberger is a shell of his former self, and every other team is being led by someone young. And, you know, you mentioned like Joe Burrow, like even Baker Mayfield or Mac Jones with the Patriots, or, you know, that there's these different teams that like have serviceable young guys that are capable of winning games, that it's a fun era to kind of watch unfold.
Yeah, it is. It is. Well, hey, let's wrap it up. It's been a good episode. Thank you everybody for listening. Thank you to our good friend. Is it John in Corvallis?
Jared in Corvallis.
Jared in Corvallis. Jared, thank you for listening to the Dog and Duck Show. And we will try to give more love to the Beavers in future episodes. But Mark, any final thoughts before we wrap this thing up?
I've got, you know, the Ducks play Friday night, which I'm assuming this episode will be dropping on a Friday. So the Ducks play Friday night, which means if they win, it'll be a totally stress-free Saturday. If they lose, it'll just make anything that happens Saturday just be painful to watch. So the mixed blessing of a Friday night game for the Ducks.
Yeah. Losing to a 1-4 Cal team, no matter how much you talk them up, is not going to make for a pleasant weekend at the Schmoor household, I'm sure. Yeah. Well, I would say that the odds of that happening are pretty low. So you can sleep well tonight and, you know, wish for the best tomorrow. But yeah, it's going to be, I think, the opposite. We've got a night game on Saturday against UCLA. So I'll spend most of the next 2 days worrying that the Dogs are going to get embarrassed, you know, and get run all over and be unable to move the ball offensively. But if they can win the game, then it will definitely make the cap of the week, you know, an exclamation point. So we're wishing for that. But with that, we'll wrap it up. And so for all my Husky fans out there, I'll say go Dogs.
And I'll say go Ducks.
We'll catch you next time. Thank you.